spend a little bit of time tonight talking about Old Testament tithes and the lessons that we can learn, even though perhaps these Old Testament tithes are not something that we participate in. As always, because we have some difficulty with the folks at home hearing what people in the audience say, if you make a comment or ask a question, I'll try to repeat it so that the folks at home can hear it. And when it comes time to read, we'll ask the folks at home to read the passages, because if they read over the Zoom connection, then it comes out and everybody can hear. If we do it from in the auditorium, they have a little bit of a difficult time hearing us. We're working on resolving that, and we will get better at that as time goes on. The first time that you're ever going to encounter the idea of a tithe or a tenth is in Genesis, the 14th chapter. Abraham is returning from battle, and he meets with Melchizedek. Now, Melchizedek is the high priest in Salem. Eventually, the city of Salem becomes Jerusalem. Melchizedek is the high priest there. He is not in Abraham's line. So he's not a participant in the Old Testament promise that was given in Genesis 12, that I'll make of you a great nation. But he nevertheless serves God. And that kind of reminds me that no matter who you are, God has always had a way for you to serve him. Melchizedek's way of serving isn't described for us in the Old Testament. We don't know very much about Melchizedek. I don't know how he served. I don't know if he made similar sacrifices to what the Jews did. But he nevertheless is a priest to God. So in Genesis 14, as Abraham is returning from battle, he has been successful, and he gives a tenth of everything that he captured in battle to Melchizedek. It's the first time that this idea of a tithe is ever mentioned. Now, that's not the Old Testament tithe that we're going to be talking about tonight. We're going to be talking about the tithes that were given as a commandment to the Jews. And we'll be referencing a lot of chapters in the Old Testament. We're not going to take the time, for instance, to read all of Numbers 18 or Deuteronomy 14, but I do want you to have those so that you can spend some time looking at them on your own to kind of reinforce what we're saying here tonight, because it comes from the passages that I've listed. There were three kinds of tithes that were commanded to the Jews. The first kind of tithe comes from the fact that when they came to the land, God said, every firstborn is mine. Every firstborn. So no matter who you were, God said, every firstborn is mine. But I'll let you have them back. In return for all of your firstborn and all of the firstborn of your cattle, firstborn of your flock, everything will be taken care of if you'll give me the Levites. So he took the entire tribe of Levi in payment for the tithe that the Jews were supposed to have given. The firstborn. The Jews, instead of giving their firstborn, gave 10% to support the Levites, because all of the tribe of Levi, when they came into the land, received no inheritance. They didn't get land. They got a few cities, the cities of refuge, but for the most part, the Levites got nothing. The land was the way that you were supported. That's no different than it is today. If you don't have some means to generate wealth, then you don't have any wealth. Well, the Levites had no land. And because of that, the rest of the tribe, the rest of the tribes all gave 10% of their income to support the Levites. Now, understand, this was not voluntary. It wasn't an offering that they gave to God. It was something that they owed to God. It was very different in its essential character than a free will offering is. This wasn't a free will offering. So they had to give 10% of their income to support the Levites. And when we think about tithes in the Old Testament, that's the tithe that we most of the time think about. But there were two others. They also had to give 10% of their income to support the festivals at the temple that they were required to attend. Remember, all the Jewish males were required to attend the festival in Jerusalem three times each year. So every time they came to Jerusalem, they brought a certain portion of the temple tithe. And it probably was divided into thirds. Deuteronomy 24 doesn't say how it was to be divided. It just talks about the fact that they had this temple tithe, or 10% of their income, that was given to support the temple and its services so that they could attend the festivals. So right now we have 20% of their income had to be given for religious purpose. First 10% would support the Levites. Second 10% supported the temple. On top of that, each third year, they had to give a tithe to support the poor. That's in Deuteronomy 14, verses 28 and 29. So it was a required, if you will, almost like a tax. It was a required tithe that they gave, not every year, they gave it every third year. And it went to support the poor. Now this tithe that they gave for the poor went to the priests, and the priests then distributed that tithe as it was necessary to care for the poor. So that was something that they gave every third year. And so I'm going to say that they gave up, it would be the equivalent of giving a third of their tithe every year. But they gave these tithes to support first the Levites, then the temple, then the poor. And this happened every time they came to Jerusalem. Okay? So depending on what year it was, if it was the third year, you gave 30% of your income. If it was year number one, year number two, year number four, five, six, or seven, you gave 20% of your income. So something like 23% of their income was given to the tithe. So when we talk about tithe, even though the idea of tithe is 10%, that was not what they gave. What they were required to do involved about 23% of their income. Now, that did not include the sacrifices that they had to make. And they had to make a morning and evening sacrifice, and then they had to make a sacrifice on the Sabbath. So if you counted all of the things that they had to do religiously, it's reasonable to say that they probably had to give about 30% of their income every year. And that's apportioning the third year tithe for the poor. It was given into the storehouse. So if you look at Malachi, the third chapter, you see Malachi having to deal with the people saying, this is terrible. We're giving so much to God, and it's such a burden, so wearisome. How could we be expected to give a third of our income? And Malachi says that the reason that you see it burdensome is because when it comes time to give a third, to give 10% of your flock to the tithe, what you do is you give the worst animals that you got. You give the ones that are no good for anything else. And Malachi says, that's why you think it's a burden. So the end result of that is, Malachi says, if you gave that to the king, he'd be insulted and he'd cut your head off. Think about what you're giving to God. You ought to be giving him the best, not the worst. And he says, bring it to the storehouse and watch how God blesses you. It won't be perceived as a burden. I have used this reference, Malachi the third chapter, verses 8 through 10, to say that when we give, we ought to give until it feels good. Now, there's some sense to that. I have read a number of different articles that research who gives the most to religious causes and to charitable causes in general. Who do you think it would be? Is it the top 1% of earners, the bottom 1% of earners? Who do you think it is that gives the most to charitable causes? Anybody?
Poor folks.
That's it. It's the bottom 10% give the most to charity. And I would also suggest they feel the best about it. People that are in the top 1% don't give nearly as much as the people that are in the bottom 1%. And that really sort of shocked me when I read that. Yeah, Bill.
When you say that, is that a percentage of their income or
yeah. The
total dollar amount?
Oh, it's percentage of income. Yeah, it's percentage of income. Because if you're, you know, Bill Gates and you give less than 0.5% of your income, you still give an enormous sum. I mean, the guy has so much money, he loans money to the U.S. Okay, so I used to say he has so much money, he loans money to God. The guy is just fabulously wealthy. So, but when you get right down to it as a percentage of income, it's the poorest among us who give the most. And I can't tell you how many of the people to whom we took Barnabas baskets had been the people who gave the most to support the Barnabas baskets. And it just happens all the time. So, the temple authorities distributed the funds. Part of the analysis that's behind this is looking at what the Jewish rabbis wrote about where it was given and how it was distributed. That's not spelled out as clearly in the Old Testament as the 10%. But they gave it into the storehouse or a temple treasury. That's the reason why when you read about Nebuchadnezzar destroying the city of Jerusalem, he had been down to Egypt, he had fought a war, he's on the way back to Babylon, and as he went through Judea, he raided the temple, because that's where the wealth was. It was kind of like, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. Well, he robbed the temple and took the things of the temple, the things of service, back to Babylon, as well as the money that they had collected that would have been devoted to the poor. This was not stuff that was distributed at an individual's discretion. This was something that you gave, and then distribution was made. You were required, beyond that, you were required to give it, and distribution was made. This idea that you could be required to make religious contribution continues today. There are churches that will sue you if you don't meet the agreed amount that you're going to give to the religious organization. Chief among them is the Mormon Church. They are outstanding by virtue of the number of suits that they have filed against people who did not meet their tenth. It's kind of like a tax. That's a bad way to say it, but that's kind of what it reminds me of. It was put into the common treasury and then distribution was made. It's kind of like Social Security. You know, I pay into Social Security. Everybody else pays into Social Security, or most of us do. And you pay into Social Security, and then the Social Security administrators decide how that money is going to be spent. You don't have a pot of money that belongs to you. You pay in, and the Social Security Administration determines who qualifies for supplemental income. So if you're disabled, you get supplemental income. That comes out of the money that I put into Social Security. So when I retire, I don't collect from my pot that I established with Social Security. I collect from the money when I retire, and I turned 70, so I had to draw Social Security. Wasn't gonna do any better, so I started drawing Social Security. You know who pays my Social Security? Nolan. Not me. The money that I put in was spent long ago. This is the way that the tithe worked. It wasn't something that you controlled. Now, let's talk about the things that you did control. That wasn't the extent of the relation of the requirements that God had for people as they thought about their income. If there was a man who was in need, you also were required to help him. You could not say to him, there's money in the temple tax, in the temple treasury. Go collect it over there. Just like if there's a need today, I can't say to someone, go downtown and you can apply for food stamps and you can do this and you can do that. I've put money in there and you can use that money to take care of yourself. Now, that's a reasonable thing for people to do, but that's not what we're talking about when we talk about the need that people had to respond as individuals to someone that was in need. So I, for instance, when I harvested my field, I had to leave the corners. That was to be gleaned by the poor. I remember my grandfather farmed corn, and when you harvest the corn, you have to turn the tractor around. Well, that knocks down a whole bunch of corn. Now, we didn't leave that for the poor to gather. My job, when I was a little kid, my job was to pick the ears of corn that got knocked down in the tractor turn area. So I was hand harvesting, but they couldn't do that. When they turned their tractor, they didn't have tractors, but when they turned their team around, they knocked down necessarily some corn, and you had to leave that. That was for the poor. So that was a requirement that God laid on you, but it was outside of the tithe. You'd already given the tithe for the poor. And then on top of that, they had to lend with no interest to those people that were Jews. They could not charge usury. It was called usury in the Old Testament. You could not charge usury or any interest on money that you loaned to a fellow Jew. You loaned it because he had need. And he would repay it, but he only repaid the principal. Now, that, if you think about that in terms of opportunity cost, they were giving money that they could have used to make more money. They were giving money to the poor man because he needed it, and what they were getting back was the principal that they had given him. But every seventh year, you had to forgive all debt. Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is quite part of that, but there were supposed to be not sure if there were laws or guidance that if there were not supposed to be any poor in Israel, you were always supposed to uphold your brother so that he didn't live in poverty.
Right. And Bill is talking about the idea that there were no poor people in Israel. There were people who had to be supported, who had to be helped, but no one went without because you had these laws. So, let's review for just a minute. You had to give about 30% of your income to be a Jew, just in terms of sacrifices and tithes. And on top of that, you needed to support the poor man in whatever way he needed to be supported. And every seventh year, you had to forgive all the debts. That, now, when you read Deuteronomy 1, verse chapter 15, what you see is Moses is reiterating that you can't say, wait a minute, it's the sixth year. I'm not going to loan you any money because you're only going to give me back 1 year's worth of repayment on this. And then I have to forgive your debt. I'd love that. You know, I bought a house. Sounds really good that I have to make payments for 1 year. And at the end of 1 year, then all my debt is canceled. That sounds really good from my perspective. From the perspective of the person that's loaning money, if the bank knew that they were only going to collect from me for 1 year, trust me, I couldn't afford my house. Because they would recoup all of their money in 1 year. And Moses said, don't do that. Don't do that. You lend to the man who needs the help, without regard for debt forgiveness in year seven. That amounts to a lot of money. That's a lot of support for the poor man. Yeah, Bob.
Well,
was that set up so that there was a 7-year anniversary for the whole nation at a specific time? Or would that be an individual thing, like you buy the house, you have a 7-year balloon payment these days?
You know, I don't know the answer. Bob's question is, was that the same for everybody? Everybody worked on the same 7-year rotation. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I would have to go back and look.
It wouldn't seem equitable that you could set it up where someone could take advantage of it by doing the 1-year thing.
Right.
At the 6-year and not have to pay it back.
Right. It doesn't seem equitable to me, but that may be what God is saying. It's not. I look at it and say, that's not fair. And God says, I don't care. Fair is not a part of the picture. Remember the parable that Jesus told about the laborers that went out to labor in the vineyard, and some people started early in the morning and some people started at the last hour, and everybody got paid the same?
Every creditor.
Dean?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Lee says the answer is in verse 15, at the end of every 7 years, you shall be granted a remission of debts. And then they had the year of Jubilee, which was the 50th year, and they had to let people out. So it was the whole nation that was doing this.
Okay. That was a good point, Lee. On top of this, you had the 50th year Jubilee. If you had purchased land from someone at the 50th year, all the land went back to its original owner. So that was the way that God took care of people having to mortgage their land, and then you wound up with all the land in just a very few hands. Yeah, Bill.
For the year of Jubilee, it was bought or sold on the basis of how many years crops you could get out of it. So that was different than a 7-year salary.
That's true.
I think that the Jubilee, that was every seven years, 49, 50 years. So I think those 7-year periods were a part of that Jubilee. It was a set time for the whole nation.
Yeah, that would be my thought. I understand the point Bob is making. That doesn't seem fair. You know, as the person who's lending the money, that doesn't seem fair. And God may say, just like he said to the owner of the vineyard said to the people that had labored all day in the heat, he said, I don't care whether you think it's fair or not. Yeah, Bill.
The point about this, it doesn't seem fair. God is saying, you don't live on the basis of money. I bless you. If you do what I tell you to do, you're going to have plenty.
That's true.
You know, don't worry about the money.
That's true. And Israel, for the most part, did not keep these commandments. In fact, keeping the year of Jubilee was so rare that when you had a good king and he tried to restore everything, the way that he's described is, and he restarted the year of Jubilee. They kept the year of Jubilee finally, because they didn't do it. They and you can understand, this requires a lot on the part of the Jew. But Bill makes the good point. If you do this, I'll bless you. The thing is, if you start looking at how much this is costing, then, and you say, man, if I wasn't giving so much to God, I could buy that boat. Essentially, God says, no, you give it to me, and if you need the boat, I'll give you the boat. The reason that resentment builds up is because we're looking at it the wrong way. It's like Bill said, don't look at how much it costs. look at how much God is willing to bless you. Okay? Other comments? Anybody at home? Okay. So what does all of this mean for us? Well, we don't keep the tithe. There's no question about it. That's not required of us. There is no, it's not even required for Jews today, because there is no tribe of Levi to support. There is no temple to support so that you can make your annual journey. They couldn't keep it if they wanted to. That's the upshot of the destruction of the temple in AD 70. And all of the records that showed who was in what tribe were burned. They were lost. There was another copy that was kept in Alexandria, and they even lost that one in the fire. So you couldn't even, you know, refer to your computer backup. There are no Levites anymore, so you can't keep the tithe. And you don't make sacrifices. We have a sacrifice, but it's Jesus. And if you think about what it cost him his life. So he was, to say that we don't have sacrifices anymore, that's true that we don't make sacrifices like they did, but we have the best sacrifice that there ever was. They gave a lamb, we give the Son of God. That can't, and there is no comparison in terms of cost. So we don't live under the law of Moses. We have noted this on multiple occasions. Romans the 6th chapter, verse 14. Romans the 7th chapter, verse 6. Galatians 5 at verse 18. That is not our law. We live under a different law. No New Testament commandment was given to tithe. Not tithe number 1, 2, or 3. Now, we do have a requirement by God to voluntarily support. That, remember, these were not voluntary things for the Jews. Part of what they did was voluntary. Giving to the man that was in need, that was voluntary. Most of what they did was not voluntary. What we do is voluntary. And that's the best place to see that is 2 Corinthians 8. Paul is taking a contribution to Jerusalem. And he praises those people for the voluntary nature of their willingness to support those people that were in need in Judea because of the famine. So God loves a cheerful giver. That's us deciding that we can support the poor. And that's sort of the outcome of 1 Corinthians 16. At verses 1 and 2. There is this famine in Judea. The apostle is going to come through town. He says to everybody, but this is before he ever gets there. He says, lay by in store. As you have prospered, so that there will be no gatherings when I come. So what on earth does lay by in store mean? I've tried to ponder that. I looked at the individual words. That really didn't help much. What is this idea of laying by in store? If you look at some of the more modern translations, they say set aside and save. Not lay by in store. Lay by in store is kind of King James Version. And that's really the only place that you find that phrase, lay by in store. What does it mean? So I started thinking about how we could have funds to respond to a person who was in need, or to respond to a specific need like the need in Jerusalem. And it occurred to me that one of the things that we might do is to say, I'm going to keep $100 in my wallet. I will not spend it for anything other than caring for the poor man. So somebody comes in and they're hungry. I can say to them, here is money. You can buy your lunch. Or I could say, come with me. I'll buy your lunch. But I have $100 in my... I don't get into the situation where I say, you know, I would give you some money, but I don't have any money in my wallet. Let's go down to the bank, and I'll use my ATM card, and I'll withdraw the funds, and I'll have some money to give to you. Now, think about them in the first century. They didn't have ATMs. The way that they generally saved whatever money they had to accumulate wealth was they would convert it to some sort of silver utensil. In the early American colonies, silversmiths were pretty important because they took people's accumulated wealth and they would turn it into something like a silver spoon. Now, it was silver, so that was wealth, but it was also a tool that you could use. You could eat with a silver spoon, or you could have a teapot or a pan or something like that, but that represented your wealth. You couldn't, if a poor man came in and you said, I would give you something, but we're going to have to go over here to Paul Revere's shop, and he's going to have to melt down the silver, and then we're going to have to sell the silver and figure out how much we can get for the silver. That's not laying by in store. That's not setting aside and saving. But to say, I will keep $100 in my wallet that is specific for this purpose. I will not spend it for anything else. It's set aside. It's devoted to God, and I will keep it in my wallet. Yeah, Bill.
One thing I heard when I was a teenager when I first started to believe that, well, it stuck with me, is that what we give to God is going into a spiritual account.
That it goes into a spiritual account, and you know, the parable of the rich young farmer who said, oh, look how much I've prospered this year. I have to tear down my barns and build bigger barns. And Jesus said, this night your soul is required. Who does this belong to now? Remember the way that Jesus addressed the Pharisees. He said they like to stand on the street corner and give alms so that they can be seen of men. He says they have their reward. They have the whole thing. That when he says they have their reward, that's a word that you would use for you got paid everything that you earned. The reward of men.
The will
they gave for Mike. That's
right. Said about her.
That represented all of her living. The widow's mite probably illustrates what we've observed just by observing society.
She's given more than everybody. She gave her heart. She gave her
life. Right. And you had the Pharisees who walked by the treasury and gave a bunch of coins, and they made it sound like they were giving a bunch of coins. They didn't slip it into the treasury. You know, when they wrote their check, they made sure that they put it in the plate face up so everybody could read it. That's a silly illustration, but you see what they were doing. Did you have a comment, Vicki?
No.
No. Okay. That's okay. Anybody else? And I have made it a practice to do this, to keep $100 in my wallet, and Kim does too. I have arrangements with hotels that if I send a person to the hotel, they will give them a room to stay in for the night and send me the bill. The hotel, it's not the best hotel, it's not, you know, the Hyatt, or it's not the, what is it, the Graduate downtown, the nice hotel. It's the Eugene Inn, okay. It's clean, it's a place to get a shower, it's a place to spend the night. It's a place where most of us would go to spend the night, frankly. So I have set aside a certain amount that's for that purpose. Yeah, Vicki. I don't know. When I read this passage, 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, on the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store, if God has prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come. I know that what's happening is Paul is going through town, and he's going to take whatever they have set aside and saved to Jerusalem, along with some other people that the church might appoint to go with him. Okay? And he wanted to make sure everything was open and above board, so that's why he was taking extra people with him. What does it mean to set it aside and save it, that there be no gatherings? I look at that and I think, on the one hand, it makes sense to say that you're putting it into the treasury. And then from the treasury, the gift is given to Paul. And that way you avoid a gathering when Paul gets there. That makes sense. It also could make sense that you set it aside and save so when Paul gets there, you give it to him. It's something that you have set aside. It's not like you say, well, I have this money that I have decided I'm going to give to this purpose, and I need to go sell my CD. That would be not setting it aside and saving it to avoid the gathering. But if you set it aside, saved it, and you were ready to give it when Paul came to town, that too would meet the statement in 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2. I don't know. I think both of those may be possible.
Dean?
Yeah.
In that one case, it's a particular thing, and it's something that they vowed to do. So they are actually fulfilling a vow. But if we talk about giving money to the Lord weekly, one thing that happens in that statement is as you prosper. And let's say that you decided that you're going to give $100 every week, but your car blows up. Now you got to get to work. Okay? You're not prospering right now. And so the Lord, I think, understands when you say, Lord, I can't give this to you now. I'll have to try and make it up later. Because you have to have a car to feed your children.
Right. And you make a good point, Carol. If it's in my control, then if I had set aside $100 and a famine happened in Colombia, I could decide I need to divert that money. It's mine. I can divert it. If I've given it into the common treasury, it's not mine. I can't decide to divert it at that point. But you make a very good point. We give as we've been prospered. You know, I grew up in Kentucky where basically if you were a farmer, you prospered once a year when you sold your tobacco crop. That was income. And if you're a teacher, you know, you only get paid 9 months out of the year. Do you have to? You have to survive in the summer. You don't prosper in the summer unless you teach summer school, I guess. But you know, I've kind of been there. I was a teacher for a while, and I know that I was like a lot of other people. I tended to run out of money before I ran out of summer. I would set aside and save to have it for the summer, and it seemed like I always ran out before that first paycheck got there in September when we went back to school. And, farmers, now I know some farmers who say, I know what I'm going to prosper. I can reasonably anticipate what my tobacco crop is going to sell for. So I divide that up into 52 portions, and I give 1/52nd of that every Sunday so that I can make a weekly contribution. And I know other farmers who make one lump sum contribution. When they sell their tobacco crop, a proportion of that has been set aside in their mind. It's going to God. So they make that contribution to God first, and then they spend the rest. In either case, I guess what I'm saying is we have put an emphasis on lay by in store on the first day of the week, when that may not be the only way that this could be understood. Now, do I tend to think that the gathering that he's talking about was, it's all in one place? I tend to think that, but I can't say I can't say that's the only way to understand it. And just let me give you, this is an analysis of 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2 that I ran across. This is an old statement that was republished in something called, on a website that's called versebyverseministry.org. And this is the way that they describe it. Paul gives no specific destination for our giving, but says that our giving is to be done by putting aside in savings. And when it says lay by in store, that word store is thesaurus. Sometimes it does mean a storehouse. Many times it also means to simply lay it by yourself. It's in your bag. So you lay by him in store. This is an important, rarely followed practice. The literal phrase in Greek in 1 Corinthians 16:2 means to store up privately. Now they kind of overstated that, because that's not the only meaning of that Greek phrase. Paul's expectation was that the believers in Corinth could consistently set aside some of their earnings reserved for the needs of the saints. With that part of that statement, I absolutely agree. The believer wouldn't distribute those funds until a need presented itself, so that until there was a need, this weekly giving would remain stored up privately. He has it for the purpose of meeting a need. And then they make this statement, and this statement I'm not sure that I can support. The church wasn't in a position to collect and store tithes. I don't know whether that is true or not. The church could have been in that position. Instead, the money remained in the hands of the individual believer until it was needed for some specific purpose within the body, at which time the believer would be asked to withdraw some funds from their savings and give it in support of the need. That's why Paul wanted believers to save each week, so that they would be ready to give a donation when they were asked. That's why I carry $100 in my wallet, so that when the need arises, I can immediately meet it. I don't have to say, let's go down to the bank, or, you know, I would give that money, but I need to go cash in my CD. The individual can use that money that he set aside and saved to generate more money. I can set it aside and save it and put it in a money market fund. I can have access to it any day of the week, but I still get to earn 3% on that money, which goes back into the pot of the money that I've set aside and saved. I don't think the church is in the position of building a savings account on which they earn money as a goal. The church distributes money. The church doesn't save money. I distribute and I save. So there's a difference between the individual and the church. Well, we spent a lot of time on this, and I hope that it's helpful. I wish that I could tell you I know exactly what this means. I just can't. And you're individually going to have to decide this. Yeah, I mean, no, I'm not saying that. There are still needs that I meet within the corporate body. But if I die, Kim won't keep that money. She'll put it in the plate. It was already set aside for that purpose.
But you're not mixing
up the two. No, I'm not mixing the two. Okay. No. But that money, even though it's in my wallet, and I individually distribute it, it belongs to God. Right. So, if you know, and there have been times when the money that we set aside, because we set aside money each week for that purpose, dedicated for that, we also contribute to the corporate needs. But this is something that we do over and above that, okay? And there, you know, if I go for 6 months and don't encounter someone in need immediately that I have to meet, then that fund can get, it's not going to get massive, but I would build up a fairly good kitty, okay? But again, that's money that I've set aside by me so that I can meet the needs that I encounter. Over and above corporate needs. And we do have corporate needs. I mean, we have to keep the lights on. So I suppose we could all, on the first of the week, or first of the month, John would send us and information about, well, our electric bill this month was X number of dollars, so here's the bag that we need to put that money in to
send it off to the electric company. We could simply give that money into the common treasury and say to John, when the electric bill comes due, you pay it. That's why we put it there. Okay? Other questions at home? Hope it helps rather than muddy the water. But sometimes the more I study, the more it seems to get muddy and the less I am sure that it has to be this way and this way only. The more I understand that people may have different approaches. Okay?